Hello, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, fellow travelers along the way. Welcome to another episode of the Avalon Mentors Podcast.
Afternoon.
Good morning. Good morning, Will.
How be you today?
I'm doing all right. Sun is warm. The sky is clear. Life is good. In the midst of moving apartments right now. So forgive my slightly disheveled appearance. Can't see most of it, but nonetheless.
Yeah, you look like hell. I was just going over here about a new venture that I was coming up with. I don't know if you caught any of that, but...
No, I didn't.
Well, I watched on YouTube, 10 hours. I didn't watch all 10, but there's like a video you can find 10 hours of watching squids in a tank, just, you know, floating around for 10 hours.
Mesmerizing.
It was. And I thought, wow, that's kind of cool. I could do that.
Okay.
So, you know...
You can float around in a tank.
Yeah, sure. You know... It's like 3, maybe 4 hours of me just sitting around, right? You know, in this day and age, you don't get out much. If you don't have a friend, you're lonely, whatever. You know, you just put on Lassiter sitting around for 3 hours.
Right.
Boom, you got a companion in the room with you. And, you know, if you appreciated my work, you could send me money. It would be kind of a lucrative operation.
Right.
To be,
you know.
Sitting around.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, cool. I don't know. It'll never fly.
It has problems.
So you're moving. Wow. That's quite the venture.
It is. It is. We're just moving into temporary digs, still in town here, just into a different apartment.
I see.
While we continue on our longer term adventure.
Yes, indeed. Indeed. Good luck to you on that. That's
thank you.
Yeah, and I understand your time is a little limited today, so I won't blather on like I usually do. We'll try and keep it successful.
Yeah, we'll try
and we're doing Hobbit chapter 15, and we're getting much closer to the end here. We have, I think it's like 3 more chapters, I think. Sounds right?
That sounds right.
Yeah, so we're very close to the end, which I'm kind of chuffed about. Okay. It's 19 chapters all total, so it's 4 more chapters. Yeah, 4 more chapters. But chapter 15, this is the gathering of clouds. And it's chapter 15, and here we've got Smaug dead, and we've got something's happening on the horizon. We don't know what it is yet, and here we kind of find out where things are going to come to a head. Before we get into the actual text, I was thinking the other day about the numbers, you know, the 19 chapters that he has. And I don't know, I don't have a window into his creative process, but why 19 chapters, and why did he, was he trying to stretch things out at all? Or was he simply Mad Hatter says, talking until he stopped? I don't know. It seems kind of interesting to me that he would do that.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure. I mean, this is something that I assume would be actually documented somewhere.
Mm.
Insofar as my understanding is, there's a fair bit of documentation. That's what letters back and forth, you know, mm-hmm. to him and the his editor. In the publication of The Hobbit. But I'm not sure. I don't know off the top of my head. I have an intuition that 19 doesn't necessarily have any special significance. It's just that's as many chapters as it came out to be in the end of it. But the way that what interests me far more is the way the material is organized within those 19 chapters. As we pointed out in some previous episodes, there's kind of this golden ratio architecture going on with the book. So it's like, you know, just about 2/3 of the way in, you really have this pivotal moment. And then the book is further divided into 3 movements. And you can see that and follow along. It may be that it's 18 plus one.
Maybe.
Which would not be unprecedented. I mean, Dante himself does this in the Divine Comedy. One of the cantos has like an extra chapter. One of the canzone has an extra canto in it. Whoa, excuse me. rugs flying off the railing here. Otherwise, hanging out a beautiful Italian town window here.
Yeah, Dante. Yeah,
so, I mean, I think there's something to that. You know, you've got 6 times 3, which is 18, and then you have a +1. And so there may, in fact, be something meaningful in that. Because 19 is important, but because of the way the material is organized within it.
Yeah, and I'm not totally ruling out the idea that Tolkien had some end in mind or some structure in mind that he was putting all this together. I mean, I think that we have to be careful on the one hand when we look at any work of art to not read into the artwork. I mean, for instance, there have been people that have speculated about why 3 in the Lord of the Rings. You know, it's a Trinitarian number and it was supposed to be 3 elves, kings, and all this. No, he broke it up because his publisher didn't want to publish this huge tome.
You know, huge things like this. Yeah.
Yeah. So sometimes it's accident or just a happenstance. But I think that a lot of artwork is somewhere between this absolute genius creation and this, I just had to get it on paper business, you know, somewhere in there is a spectrum. I mean, I know with Tolkien that there are some things where his genius, I mean, even Homer nods, right? As the phrase goes, there are some moments where Tolkien's genius, it gets a little rough. Like in the sketches for Lord of the Rings, he was planning originally to have a character, not Frodo, but Bungo Baggins.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
And he got rid of that. I think Bungo shows up in the family tree, but he's not the main character. Because that would have been a bit to have Bungo be the main character on every single page of the work.
Right.
Doesn't work out. Or maybe it was Bingo or something. He had Bingo. I forget what
it was. Yeah, it was something ridiculous. So that just goes to show kids, don't submit your first draft.
Yeah, it was ridiculous. That's the point. So somewhere in there is the realm of what he was actually doing this great work. It doesn't make it any less a work; it's still a great work. But I do find sometimes when I, you know, the dragon dies. Like I said before, the dragon dies. You think that would be it, and you'd be hard pressed to stretch it out to another 2.5 hour movie. You know, after that, it'd be really kind of ludicrous to try and do that. But there is certainly material here. We have four more chapters after this one. So it's kind of striking how we just keeps on going. He has more to say, I guess. So in this one, we have the meeting with these crows that occurs. And then you have the confrontation with the men and elves in front of the gate of Erebor. And I think that's, you know, that's a basic summary of the plot, but we could go into a couple things about who these characters are that we meet along the way. We have, first off, you know, Thorin says something strange is happening, and so they try to figure out what's going on. And there's this really interesting bit where they say, gosh, I wish we had some ravens here with us. And I'll kick off with this quotation here in the beginning of the chapter. Something strange is happening, says Thorin, because he just senses it. And Bilbo pointed out and says, there's that old thrush again. It seems to have escaped when Smaug smashed the mountainside, but I don't suppose the snails have. Sure enough, the old thrush was there, and as Bilbo pointed, he flew toward them and perched on a stone nearby. Then he fluttered his wings and sang. He cocked his head on one side as if to listen, and again he sang, and again he listened. I believe he's trying to tell us something, said Balin, but I cannot follow the speech of such birds. It is very quick and difficult. Can you make it out, Baggins? As though Bilbo is supposed to know more than he does on bird speech, right? Not very well, said Bilbo. As a matter of fact, he can make nothing of it at all. But the old fellow seems very excited. I only wish he was a raven, said Balin. I thought you did not like them. You seemed very shy of them when we came this way before. Those were crows, and nasty, suspicious-looking creatures at that, and rude as well. You must have heard the ugly names they were calling after us. But the ravens are different. There used to be great friendship between them and the people of Thror, and they often brought us secret news, and we were rewarded with such bright things as they coveted to hide in their dwellings. So here, the neat thing here is that, first off, like I said, it's amazing that they assume Bilbo knows more than they do. So we've come to a point now where Bilbo's consulted almost like an authority on things that the dwarves don't quite know what to do with, because he's done much now. But on the other hand, wish there was a raven, because these ravens obviously have a long history with the dwarves, right?
And ravens have the power of human speech.
Yeah.
And I think that's a key, that's something not to be overlooked. I mean, even in the real world, a raven can be trained to speak like in limited ways, not quite like an African gray parrot, but it can mimic sounds. It can mimic human speech under the right conditions. Certain varieties of ravens better than others, but not crows, because crows are different from ravens.
Yeah. Both dark feathered birds, dark colored birds, black colored birds. But there's a distinct difference between them, even in intelligence, apparently.
Yeah.
Just the other day, the crows, they're smart enough, but they're not really as clever as the raven. The raven is a creature which not only can figure out complex details, complex tasks, it can pass those complex tasks on to its progeny. In other words, apparently they're teaching birds how to adapt to these complex situations, which is, that's a little weird.
Right. A bird, a big black bird.
Yeah. It was an Alfred Hitchcock movie, right? You know, they gather there on the thing, wait for you.
Right. They're learning. They watch. They learn. Clever girl.
Clever girl. There's something very, it's not unnerving. It's just, it's very serious about a raven. The raven is something, not something which threatens necessarily, but it's almost like lurking in the background, waiting to take your trap.
But that's the thing. So a raven is after your shiny things, like a magpie.
Yeah.
But though infinitely smarter than a magpie, but a crow is a carrion feeder.
Yep.
A crow is a carrion feeder. And this is where we run into some problems in Italy here, is crow is, of course, the etymological equivalent of corvus in Latin, or corvo in Italian, right? But corvo is not a crow. Corvo is a raven.
Yeah.
And so there was recently a PR mistake in a local group that's affiliated with a Benedictine monastery. And if you know Benedictine stuff, there's an association with a raven, sort of as a symbol. St. Benedict, part of the story of St. Benedict. There's actually a lot packed into that. Maybe mention something of it in a moment. But there's this group of like a nonprofit, group, friends of the monastery kind of thing, and they're called La Banda del Corvo e Colomba, the raven and the dove. They put up their website in English, and they called and they said the crow and the dove,
the crow,
the noble crow, the noble crow just doesn't have a ring to it unless it's a pub, then that works, but crow, though that would be the how do you say it? That's the word. Corvo is crow, crove, crova, crovies, there's an old Scots word for them too, that's Corbies, right?
Corbies,
it's the same thing, but those are carrion feeders, which in Italian is a cornaccio. I explained this to my friend who runs this organization. He was shocked. He's like, oh no, that's not good. Because a cornaccio is, as crow, is this sinister carrion feeder, right? It's a death, a harbinger of death, right?
Yeah.
Even later on when, in Lord of the Rings, Theoden is under the enchantment of Saruman via Wormtongue, and he calls Gandalf the like a crow following battle, hoping to peck dead men's flesh. It calls him Gandalf Storm Crow.
Right.
But a crow is something sinister and nasty, whereas a raven is not. A raven is something that we see in Christian scriptures, Judeo-Christian scriptures, and throughout Christian cultures, the raven plays a significant role in being a messenger of the divine.
Yes.
Particularly divine providence.
Yep.
Right. So there's a raven involved in Noah's Ark.
Noah's Ark.
Raven feeds Elijah. Yep. And a raven plays a pivotal role a couple of times in St. Benedict's life, as well as, and that same theme is repeated in other monastic literatures, other monastic saints, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and to the naked eye, I think people confuse the two because they seem very similar. But there's such a distinction between the two that the names for the birds themselves really emerge from very different roots, even as far back as Indo-European. So if we're looking at like the roots of the word, the raven is pretty old. It's the old English is hyphen, with an H, Old Norse is Hrafn.
Oh, sure.
That's a very different word from what we're looking at when we're looking at crow. Crow, as you said, is related to the corvo, corvus in Latin. Mm-hmm. The Indo-European word comes down to us in Old English as kral, or as in German, krawa or krae. And so there's hardly any similarity between the words themselves, which means that even as early as the Indo-European peoples, they were distinguishing between these two different birds, not as synonyms. No, they weren't synonyms, but they were, this is this bird and this is that bird. The crow, that was the bird that would go out on the battlefield and eat all the corpses too. And so you sense that this bird was definitely a bird of the underworld. This is a bird that dealt with carrion and trash and et cetera, et cetera. Ravens, on the other hand, were seen as much more noble and much more clever, birds. That they would gather, as you said, trinkets, more like a magpie, gathering shiny things. And if I remember right, too, wasn't there a weapon in Roman culture, ancient Roman culture, called a corvus? I think that's right.
It sounds familiar.
And it was, I know, it was during the Punic Wars, right, because the Romans were not sea peoples originally. And they were fighting the Phoenicians in the Punic Wars, who were sea people. And so the Romans decided to force themselves to become sea peoples. They literally trained themselves to become ocean-going people, had no ships. And so they trained on the land first, how to row, how to move tackle around, things like that, while they were building their ships to fight the Phoenicians. And then they decided, well, we really aren't that good at the sea, but we're really good on the land. And so let's make sea battles into land battles. And they created this tool at the front of their boats called a corvus, because it was shaped like the beak of a crow. And it was almost like a pole that would come down with a spike on the end of it, come down, slam into the other ship and hit the deck. And then they would rush over the bridge onto the other ship and then beat the tar out of the Phoenicians. And that's how they defeated them in the first and second Punic Wars, was by using this thing, the corvus. I also thought that was kind of neat.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, that's fascinating, because for them that would mean raven, rather than crow.
Yeah, right.
And so they're not. We might be tempted to think from our, Anglo-Germanic, linguistic framework that they're thinking they're doing something pretty nasty and really pulling over one on the enemy, or somehow bringing death. You know, we think that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But it's a really clever thing.
And yeah, it is.
It's fitting that way. They're pulling a clever move. Something that's of a much more sophisticated bird.
Yeah.
And that shouldn't throw us. I mean, there's other examples where, between the different Indo-European languages, the cognate, the sort of etymological cognate means a different kind of thing, or they've switched places. We do this with wolf and fox as well.
Yes.
In the Romance languages, vulpus means fox, not wolf, even though that's the same as what our word wolf means, and they use lupus. For wolf, these kind of mutations happen.
Yeah, all the time.
The fact that there's these two things maintain distinction is what we want to observe.
Yeah. Well, the main distinction too, I think, is in the Norse mythology, especially because that's what he's drawing from. That's what Tolkien's drawing from.
And so
he's got reference to when they finally have this raven show up. They've got reference to two crows. I mean, there's Roach and Kark. That's right, Roach and Kark. And Roach is the son of Kark, the older crow.
Raven, yes.
Sorry, Raven. I'm going to do that a lot, by the way, because I'm still Raven Crow thing.
Yeah.
So Roach is the old raven, and Kark is his father, who's now deceased. And Roach comes to speak to them. And Balin himself has said earlier, says, you must have heard the ravens are different. They live many a year, and their memories are long, and they hand on their wisdom to their children, which obviously was happening, even for Tolkien's time. I knew many ravens of the rocks when I was a dwarf lad. This very height was once named Raven Hill, because it was a wise and famous old Kark and his wife that lived here above the guard chamber. And so anyway, the thrush goes and he gets the son of Kark, Roach, to come to them. And Roach and Kark taken together, they're very similar to the Norse mythology of Munin and Hunin, I think their names are. Hugin and Munin. Hugin and Munin were the two ravens that counseled Odin originally. So the story goes that Odin, and if I get it wrong, I'm sorry, all you mythology experts out there. Odin seeks wisdom, and so he goes to basically to give an eye in order that he can gain wisdom. And he gives this eye to, I think it's like a witch woman or something like that, who grants him supreme wisdom. And with that, he has these two crows that then accompany him and allow him to see better in the world, because they bring him news and they're constantly advising him on either shoulder, telling him what's going on in the world and giving him counsel. And this is this story here. Let me see if I can find it. This story here goes way back. This is as early as the early Edda stories. And the two of them represent, I'm thinking, something about that seriousness of the underworld. Oh, I lost it. I lost you there, laddie.
That ain't him back.
You're back then. So I was going on and on about Hugin and Munin.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Okay.
And the passage from Snorri Sturluson goes, two ravens sit on Odin's shoulders and whisper all the news which they see and hear into his ear. They are called Hugin and Munin. He sends them out in the morning to fly around the whole world. And by breakfast, they are back again. Thus he finds out many new things, and this is why he is called Raven God. And so Snorri has this source that he gets, Eddic poem of Grimnismal. And in that one, Odin says, Hugin and Munin fly every day over all the world. I worry for Hugin that he might not return, but I worry more for Munin. And the website that I'm looking at here is, this is NorseMythology.org website, Hugin and Munin, called Norse Mythology for Smart People, which I kind of like that website. But the point being is that he had, as his counselors, these two dark birds that would go around the world and give him all this information so that he was able to make constant judgments and guide the Aesir the way that they needed to be guided. I can't help but think that in some ways, the darkness of those birds and the seriousness of those birds and the cleverness of those birds were what we're getting at here, is that wisdom comes from a dark experience of the dark places, an experience of seriousness in the world. Wisdom doesn't come from the light, frivolous birds, you know, with the beautiful feathers.
With the wren or something.
Right, exactly. The Rhoda doesn't have, you know, he doesn't have peacocks on his shoulders.
Right.
He has these ravens. And they fly around the world, which means they see everything, technically. They're the all-seeing birds. And I think he's even referred to as the all-seeing Odin at some points, because he has the birds that help him out. So anyway, that's the story of Hugin and Munin, which I think he's reflecting here in this chapter. There's an interesting point, too, on that, which I find kind of amusing. It's a little-known thing about Norse mythology, but Odin had this horse that had 100 legs named Sleipnir, which is the bastard child of Loki. And Sleipnir was very, very fast. And so Odin would ride around on Sleipnir, especially on the winter solstice, right after the winter solstice. And in the morning of the winter solstice, he'd fly around to all the houses and he'd leave little trinkets or gifts for the children, okay? And his crows would follow him, and the crows would bring to the children coal if the children were bad. Yeah, and you see where I'm going here.
Okay?
You see where I'm going. That morphed, of course, into later a Father Christmas in English culture. And Father Christmas used to be accompanied by a very dark character who would leave the coal for children. I don't know the name of the character that followed Christmas around, but he's all coal black, and he would follow him around for bad kids, you know, the coal. And of course, in ours, we did away with the crows and with the black character, the demon that followed him around. We just get the coal business, you know. And even now, it's we just, you know, everybody gets something from Kmart. but the point being is that image of Odin on Sleipnir with the crows morphs down into our Santa Claus image at Christmas time, mm-hmm. which I find kind of fascinating. You know, so anyway, I think that's certainly what Tolkien is drawing on when he goes to write about these characters. And I look for meaning of the names Ruach and Kark. These are just onomatopoeic.
Yeah. Right. The kind of names that a raven would have.
Yeah, right.
It sounds like raven speech.
Sounds like a raven speech, exactly. So they come down and they speak to the dwarves, and they basically give them counsel. And I think the counsel that we get from them is pretty darn good.
Mm-hmm.
But the response is intriguing, that these birds, basically, they tell them, the dragon's dead, okay? And the dwarves immediately like, yay, hooray, the dragon's dead. And that's when the raven reveals, I love this part about revealing his character. It says, it was some time before Thorin could bring the dwarves to be silent and listen to the raven's news, because they're all excited the dragon's dead. At length, they have very short-term like planning, these dwarves, you know?
But
over and over again, they really plan very well for the future. I don't know what's up with that. Anyway. At length, when he had told all the tale of the battle, he went on.
So much for joy, Thorin Oakenshield. You may go back to your halls in safety. All the treasure is yours, for the moment.
This little, like, he's just...
Is it ominous?
Yeah, Debbie Downer kind of thing, you know? It's great.
But many are gathering hither beside the birds. The news of the death of the guardian has already gone far and wide, and the legend of the wealth of Thror has not lost in the telling during many years. Many are eager for a share of the spoil. Already a host of the elves is on the way, and carrion birds are with them, hoping for battle and slaughter. By the lake, men murmur that their sorrows are due to the dwarves, for they are homeless and many have died, and Smaug has destroyed their town. They too think to find amends from your treasure, whether you are alive or dead.
So he's got this sort of like, again, Debbie Downer, but this is very realistic. It's like, this is what, yeah, great, the dragon's dead, but, you know, there's stuff to face still, you know?
Raven's going to tell you like it is.
Yeah, he really does. He really does. Which I think is part of the imagery that we're dealing with the Hugin and Munin characters, and then with these. Part of the cleverness of the raven, and therefore part of the cleverness of wisdom, is that it doesn't sugarcoat life. It doesn't just brood on evil. You know, that's kind of the opposite way, almost glorifying, you know, the Goths are, oh, nobody cares. But it looks at looks at it squarely, like steadily. Like, this is what the situation is. I'm sorry, but you got your hand pinned under a rock, you know? That's, you know, your arm's pinned under a rock. What are you going to do? So he says, you know, there are elves coming and there are men coming, and you're going to have to deal with them. You can't just go rejoicing. And then I'll finish this with his advice.
Your own wisdom must decide your course. The 13 is small remnant of the great folk of Durin that once dwelt here and now scattered far. If you will listen to my counsel, you will not trust the master of the lake men, but rather him that shot the dragon with his bow. Bard is he of the race of Dale of the line of Gideon. He is a grim man, but true. We would see peace once more among dwarves and men and elves after the long desolation, but it may cost you dear in gold. I have spoken.
So again, very direct. You know, we want to see peace, but don't deal with the master. He's a skunk.
Yeah.
And if you want,
right,
you're going to have to pay. There's going to be some gold involved, which, you know, you can just see that Ruach is thinking the dwarves are not going to like to hear this, right? But they're going to have to pay.
Right.
It's just the way it is. So, and then I have spoken. That's it. I'm done.
Well, which I think is really interesting. This exchange right here is, excuse me, You know, he opens up, your own wisdom is going to have to decide your course. I'm not making the decision for you. But if you listen to my advice, here's what I would say and point out a couple obvious things. And it's going to be, essentially, he lays out two paths, sort of, you know, one by, you know, omission, but essentially saying, you know, if you want to be a, you know, a good king, like in the opening lines of Beowulf,
right.
You'll essentially give generously of your hoard of gold that you've now not won for yourself, it has been won for you even, you know, but to give generously to those about. So you can have the friendship of these people, but it's going to cost you in gold.
Mm.
You know, so you have to choose sort of, I mean, there's kind of this, you know, moment where you have to choose. Are you going to put the gold ahead of nobility, ahead of virtue, ahead of generosity, mercy even, or are you going to step up to a higher calling,
yeah,
a higher vocation at this point? But they seem to kind of choose the petty.
Yeah, I'll touch on that in just a sec. I like the way that Roach is direct with the dwarves, and he must know that they are prone to the dragon disease. You know, he's not,
right,
he's no idiot, this raven. He's very aware that they're prone to the dragon disease. And so although he is very direct, he's also careful, right? This may, mm-hmm, cost you in gold, and you may already be infected, right?
Right.
But I just really like the way this character is this very brief character is developed here, because he's not, he doesn't sugarcoat things, like I said. He doesn't mince around words, and he just, like, if you want my advice, I don't know if you do, but here it comes, you know. I'm going to give you advice whether you like it or not. It's just such a wonderful character trait. It really reminds,
yeah,
me a lot of the better people in my life, you know, or the people,
yeah,
that have done the best for me in terms of education. Because education, I think, in its best form, does exactly this. It presents you with things head on. And sometimes very hard things to deal with. You know, when you study history, for instance, if you think World War II, for instance, was all just heroic guys doing heroic deeds and coming home happy, you need to do a little bit more research, you know? It's
right,
a hell of a mess. And there are certain things, yeah, there in that study of history which are really eye-opening. Like the Rape of Nanking, for instance, the Japanese Rape of Nanking, that is a horrific bit of history. But when you study it, and you study it with eyes wide open, you get a knowledge into human nature and a knowledge into what is possible on the dark side of things,
mm-hmm,
which is an important piece of wisdom to have. Wisdom, I don't
think,
ever comes easily. It's not like Odin, you know, wisdom.
You give your left
give
eye
your,
for that.
Give your left eye for it, you know? But it's something which, if you are willing to spend that gold, you will become wiser. And that is sort of the advice that Roach is giving here. If you want peace,
yeah,
you want to be wise, you're going to have to spend this gold. It's going to cost you.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I just think it's a neat thing to have here as a chapter, you know, because we all thought it was all done with the killing of the dragon. The personal dragon has been slain. But now you have to kind of go on in the world and deal with actual human beings. And that's going to require wisdom. That's going to require these.
Right.
So, and you're right. The dwarves don't really, that's, no.
No, thanks. We'll keep the going.
Yeah. Yeah. What's behind door number three? No, I'm sticking with the gold. Thorin, his reaction is really, I don't know, petty, juvenile. Kind of,
yeah,
you'd say
he is a petty dwarf,
yeah,
without being a petty dwarf.
Yeah, he ends up being a non-king character here.
Yeah,
none of our gold shall thieves take or the violent carry off while we are alive, right? Nope,
thieves,
yeah,
thieves, the violent, like you would just right, just explain the men of Lake Town, the city is destroyed, and they seek to get amends of some sort,
right?
These aren't thieves. These are people. These are refugees. These are people in need.
Yeah, and he calls them that.
So his,
doesn't he?
Yeah. Yeah. When you're camped out like thieves before my doorstep, you'll get not a, you know, not a penny will you get. You know,
it's really, that whole exchange with the men is remarkable to me, because they come up, I think Bard is the first one who comes up to him and says, you know, I'm Bard, I slew the dragon, descendant of Girion, blah, blah, blah. It's actually rather happy to see him alive and kind of cordial.
Yes.
And Thorin's like, get off my doorstep, right? Get off my lawn. He's rude and petty to him. It's really quite startling.
Absolutely.
There's another interesting thing to me in this whole business, and this may be part of the effect of materialism, if we can call it that, right? Materialism.
Yeah.
You know, Alan Watts was famous for saying that materialists actually hate material, which I thought was kind of interesting with him. He said that, you know, a materialist is somebody who actually sees material goods as being something they need to control and dominate, and they don't actually appreciate them for what they are, which is a thing charged with the grandeur of God. It's a good observation. And Thorin's kind of that way. He's like, in this case, he's like the master who goes into the wilderness with gold in his arms to gnaw on the gold and dies of starvation.
Right.
And I think that there's a point where the men actually say, sit there in your halls of stone and chew on your gold, you know.
Eat that if you will.
Eat that if you will, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's what he does. He holds up. He builds a wall. Now he sends the ravens to go and summon his cousin, you know, his cousin Dain and the Iron Hills, and send his doughty dwarves over to break the siege. But otherwise Thorin is quite content to sit there and not share a brass button of any of this.
There are two things that come to mind in this, too, Cameron, for me, about the very nature of this materialistic view. One is, is it plays back into the natural default position of humanity, which is power. Because I'm of the opinion that human beings that are unredeemed, that is unredeemed man, the whole cycle is one of power. Who's going to dominate whom? Who, as they say in Sweeney Todd, who gets eaten and who gets to eat, right? That's the nature of power. And so what Thorin says is not you all are suffering and I'll give you gold to help you out and all this. He says, I'm going to get a bigger army than you have, and we're going to beat the crap out of you. Power, right?
Right.
Bigger stick, bigger government. And that happens over and over and over again. You see people that see the material world as something to be dominated. You see them playing power games all the time.
And that's exactly it. It's power, because you've got just from a psychological perspective, when you start moving in that kind of way, when that's how you're interacting with the world, you view the world through that lens, you know, you tend to be standing on a deep, you know, a level of deep insecurity, right? You feel that you don't have power. So you're trying to seize power over things that you feel deep down are really otherwise beyond your control, which is... There's a level of irony to that. And I think this is what's something when we do really a deep reading of the text here, that Tolkien is very intentionally, implicitly, not explicitly, trying to illustrate for us that you've got Thorin, who's feels he needs to control everything here. He wants to dominate and control the gold, dominate and control essentially the military situation, what he's all of a sudden making into a military situation, would have otherwise a humanitarian crisis. And none of this, to protect the gold, which he didn't win for himself, somebody else won it for him. Much of the gold, as we learn, as we kind of intuitively know already, but is clarified by Bard, doesn't even belong to Thorin. It's from Dale. Yep. It by right belongs to Bard in the first place. They say nothing of treasures that belonged to the elves that also had sort of made their way or been captured at some point or another and brought into the Dragon's Hoard. There's a lot that's mixed in there. So there's a lot of things all of a sudden that Thorin finds himself having responsibility for that are not his own.
Yeah.
All of this is given to him because they didn't even slay the dragon.
Laying claim to things which he ought not necessarily to lay claim to, you know, that's... Without acknowledging that he has this debt to other previous people, though. But this goes back to something which we touched on way early on. I don't think we ever rounded out on this. Why did Tolkien choose to have these 13 dwarves and not 13 men?
Right. so there's one aspect of it. The ravens being sort of a symbol of God's providence and Tolkien's providence being written throughout, you've got something that's a fundamentally rejection of providence mm-hmm. and trying to seize things of your own and sit on them. So you've got these two contrasting ways of being that are being illustrated here as the clouds again.
Yes, the clouds.
As the chapter shows. But yes, I think that's a further point, is what you just raised about why is it 13 dwarves and not 13 vagabonds, humans,
right.
Men.
It has something to do with the nature of what dwarf represents in literature, generally speaking. Mm-hmm. Nothing to do with people in the world that are actually, dwarfism or anything like that. It has to do with the nature of the symbol in literature. And over again in literature, dwarf is a half man. He's somebody who hasn't quite developed into the fullness of spirit that is
right.
Man. And here we see this very clearly, not just in Thorin's pusillanimity, right? His mm-hmm. soul the size of a hair follicle, pusillanimous.
Okay. Right.
But we also see it in his lack of humor, which I find really intriguing. This is something which over and over again, people that play into the cycle of power lack. They lack a sense of humor. And we see it when they go out, when they're all rushing off, they're like, yeah, back to the mountain, all the dwarves. And they say, back now to the mountain, said Thorin, we have little time to lose. And Bilbo cracks a joke. And little food to use, cried Bilbo. He does a little rhyming joke there. We have little time to lose and little food to use. And if they had a sense of humor, they'd all be like, yeah, that's pretty funny and true, and we need some food. And they would do that. And the humor would break up the tension, and the humor would make them see things in a different way, because that's what humor does. Dave Chappelle makes us see
exactly.
a different way. But they don't have any sense of humor. So as it says, nobody noticed that he even said this, right? They all said, back to the mountain, as if they had not heard him. So back he had to go with them. So they're all very serious now. And that'd be very serious. That to me is quite mm-hmm. startling because seriousness, we have to be serious about certain things. It's important. But part of wisdom is that it plays the role of comically dancing across seriousness, as though seriousness were not that serious.
Yeah.
It's almost elvish in that. It's almost like the writer Waite-Taro has an image of the fool of the world, who is sort of just going through the world, looking at stars and flowers and doesn't notice he's on the edge of a cliff and he's safe, everything's fine. That's what humor does. Humor like skirts over mm-hmm. the top of things that are extremely serious plays with them and kind of dances with them. It's like Tom Bombadil with a ring. It's like
Tom Bombadil. Yeah.
Look at that. Oh, lost it. Nope, there it is. And Bilbo is not a dwarf, and so he doesn't share in that deep seriousness of it's our gold and you will die. He's sort of like, what about some biscuits too? What about some coffee? That joking nature, I find to be throughout Tolkien's work, even into The Lord of the Rings, there's this constant, kind of humor.
Yeah.
Which if we take it far too seriously, we lose.
Yeah.
This is something which goes all the way back, Homer. I think one of Homer's great deeds in the Iliad is that he's making fun of the gods that irreverent play with mythology breaks the hold on the mind that those gods have. Anytime we take it far too seriously, we make it into a god and it dominates over us. And when the commandment, thou shalt have no other gods before me, comes, we're supposed to have only the one God be our God.
Mm-hmm.
And amazingly enough, that God is a God of comedy and humor. I mean, why are so many Jews comics, right? this God, Yahweh, is a God of humor, and the Old Testament is riddled with humorous stories over and over again.
Oh, yeah.
So.
Right. Or just look at the platypus.
Look at the platypus, right. Look at the sense of humor that the Lord has in creating certain idiotic things. Yes. Or look at human beings. Human beings are downright foolish. You watch Jackass the movie or something, and you get a sense of how stupid human beings can be.
So let's finish up here with this. Just again, we have the gathering of clouds, and it's a gathering of clouds, not just of these armies, but it's a gathering of clouds as that brooding nature over the mind of Thorin. Which yes, then kind of affects exactly Bilbo right. too, to a certain degree. You know, this is not going to go well, Thorin. The clouds are gathering, and there's going to be a great storm, and the storm is going to, it's going to be something psychological as well as practical.
Yeah. So, I think that's exactly right.
I think it's a good place to end where Bilbo's, this is the last words of Bilbo in the chapter. The whole place still stinks of dragon. It makes me sick. Cram is beginning simply to stick in my throat. Right? Here he is with the gathering of clouds and everything's beginning to stink of dragon. And that's not a good place to be for your final thing.
Right.
So.
Yeah.
Anyway, anything else you wanted to add before we conclude? Because that's, I think, a good place to stop here with our observation.
No, I think that's brilliant right there. The gathering of clouds is the storm within Thorin, the clouding over of Thorin's mind, the mind of the dwarves. And there, we're told everything begins to still stink of dragon.
Yeah.
It still stinks of dragon, or
yeah,
again, stinks of dragon.
Yeah. We got to get him out next time. Okay. And maybe right. a great cataclysm of some kind, like a battle might help.
Mm-hmm.
There you go. Dragon stink.
That's right. Get rid of the dragon stink. That's right. All you need is five armies.
That's right. Oh, yeah. Five. Five armies. All right. Yeah. Five armies. All right, my friend. So we'll conclude. And good luck to you on your move and all that. I wish I was there to be able to lend my mighty moves.
Thank you.
All I can do is just pray for you. And
thank you. Much appreciated.
So, and hopefully we'll find you in a good spot next time and be able to talk through that battle. Okay?
Indeed. Good.
All right. Well.
All right.
Farewell, wherever you fare, to Ares receive you at the journey's end of your move.
And let the wind under your wings bear you up to where the sun sails and the moon
walks. All right. Thank you, my friend. God bless.
All right. Ba ba da 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 ba da
That concludes another episode of Avalon Mentors Podcast. Thank you all for listening. If you enjoyed the show, would you kindly thumb the like button and also give the show a positive review on whatever platform you're listening on? Until next time, cast off the works of darkness, put upon you the armor of light. So long.